The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Monday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. Great program. I'm going to go through the announcements real quickly so we can spend more time talking with Dr. Spudas. Take note of our toll-free number. It is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Please let the phone ring and we'll bring it up, bring you up on air and answer it as quickly as possible. Remember, we have just the one toll-free line, so if you think you've been waiting to use it for too long, do send me an email and tell me you're waiting, and I'll move the caller along to make room for yourself and other callers. Again, it's 1-866-687-7223. If you are preferring email today, drspace@thespaceshow.com. That's also our website, thespaceshow.com. So there is a detailed, comprehensive newsletter that is uploaded Sunday after the Sunday show. It has all the information on the week's programming, guest bios, and what's in store for the Space Show for the future. So check it out. And in addition, note that this is the only place where we have the future events section for the program. And it's the place we change first if we have to modify our weekly schedule. So to stay current, I urge you to check that website newsletter every once in a while. But we don't always have time to modify the email newsletter. So this is sort of the Bible of our schedule. Everything we do is archived, and you can easily listen to the shows right off of our website or our blog or download from either site. There's a store on our website, upper left-hand corner, Space Show Gear. There is a very important button called Support the Space Show. You'll see it on our homepage. And remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with the OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And we're able to do these programs and bring them to you because many of you do support us, and we thank you for that support. If you have any questions, please email me again at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Visit our nonprofit website, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Also, we're copyrighted and trademarked, but all of you have permission to download our shows and to share them and pass them around on the net. So very few restrictions doing that. Just don't do anything commercial. No edits to the show, and written transcripts are not permitted. And we appreciate your following those guidelines. We podcast through gigadial.net. We thank Andrew for that service. We're in iTunes, Microsoft, Zune, a host of other places on the net, and you can subscribe to our podcast. The RSS URL is on our website. Both of our newsletters, both the email one and the long version that is on the website. If you do have any questions, let me know. And then finally, do remember that we are partially brought to you by the Secure World Foundation. And Secure World helps to promote cooperative solutions for space security. Visit their own website, which is www.swfound.org. And they have lots of white papers and conferences and other information on their site that you'll find very interesting. They also sponsor our webinar series. So our guest today is returning guest Dr. Paul Spudas. It's always a pleasure to have Paul with us. He's senior staff scientist at the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston. His research focuses on impact and volcanic processes on the planets and requirements for sustainable human presence on the moon. His bio is already up on the website and on our newsletter, and I don't want to read about him. I want to talk to him. But he is a prolific writer with great blog articles and news articles. So you can see what he's writing about, and you can even subscribe to it all at sputuslunarresources.com/blog or also blogs.airspacemag.com/moon. And I really suggest you subscribe to his stories and articles. You'll never, ever be bored. I promise you that. Paul, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm fine, David, and thank you for that glowing introduction. I hope I can live up to the praise.
Well, if not, we're just going to be like the gong show. You'll hear a big gong and the line will go dead. How do you try to do an article a week, something like that? What's your schedule or tried to be scheduled?
I don't really have a schedule. I tend to write when I see something in the news that strikes my fancy or there's been some development that I feel the need to comment on. And so they come irregularly. Sometimes a couple of weeks will go by and I won't have anything new. So I just post when I feel moved to, and it works out to be about once every couple weeks, or sometimes a little more often.
You recently posted an article that I really liked, and it was as if we were going to go be a tourist on the moon, and you were our Gray Line tour guide, and you were telling us where you were going to take us and what we were going to see on this tourist venture on the moon. And I thought that was a really great article. And, you know, I was interested in talking to you about that, why you selected those items on the tour. And, you know, would they really be accessible if we actually could get around on the moon? What would we need to be able to move those kinds of distances to see all of that?
Yeah, it was a little bit science fiction-y. The idea for it actually was my wife's, and she and I had just taken a two-week trip through the gold country of California and up through some of the national parks up there. Really enjoyed it, really enjoyed seeing not only the history but looking at the geology, too. I kind of imposed that upon her when we're on road trips. We'll stop and we'll look at rocks and we'll get the maps out and kind of try to figure out what's going on. And we just had a great time, and I thought, well, you know, sometime in the future when people are living on the moon, you could do the same thing. You could do a road trip and you could stop and see these geological and historical points of interest. And so I just kind of thought, well, if I were taking one on the moon, what route would I take and what stops would I make? And so the framing story was kind of what we're on the moon, we're doing all these different activities, so let's take a road trip and go sightseeing. And I just put down the areas and the points of interest that I found interesting. I mean, you could easily make an entirely different trip in an entirely different direction, or you could even pick different stops along the route that I picked. I just picked the stops that I did because I thought they were the most significant historically and scientifically. And I just tried to describe what you would see and what its significance was.
Well, how would you actually get around on the surface of the moon to go to those sites? Do you envision some kind of a lunar taxi cab or bus, or how would you do that?
It's a non-trivial problem. I mean, it's any time you go multiple tens to hundreds of kilometers in distance. That's a significant expedition. You're exposed to the hard radiation, so you have to worry about solar flares and the general background cosmic radiation. So you'd have to be shielded pretty well. You would probably rove on the surface. It is possible to hop ballistically between long distances. You just basically fire a rocket and you make an arc through space and you fire it and reverse to brake and you land. That's a very difficult thing to do unless you've got refueling depots on the way because it burns a lot of fuel. For example, just to get to a hop, the farthest hop you'd ever take is from a point on the moon to the antipode, the point directly opposite you on the lunar globe, and that takes as much energy as it does to get into orbit. So it's a difficult thing to hop around on the moon. So that's why I think in the future, when we go between multiple places on the surface, we'll probably rove on the surface because that can be done without too much difficulty and from various types of electrically powered motors that, again, you'd have to stop and recharge occasionally, but I think that's all those are solvable problems. So I envision something like the original Lunar Molab or the Lunar Winnebago idea, where you've got sort of a big pressurized rover that can handle several people and keep them safe over the period of weeks. Probably not without resupply. You'd probably have to cache depot supplies for them along the route. But certainly you could do a trip like that on the ground. There's no trafficability issues. I'm sure you could reach all of those spots.
Even with such little tiny gravity on the moon, hopping would be a challenge?
It is, yeah. Mainly because there's no atmosphere on the moon, so it's entirely propulsive. So, you can imagine taking off and adading maybe 800 to 900 meters per second velocity to get you on a big ballistic arc. But then you have to apply that same impulse at the other end to slow down. Now, you don't want to impact the moon at 800 meters per second. so you need to both take off and then brake on the other end. And that's doable. I mean, you can imagine vehicles that would do that. But the problem is after one or two hops, you're not going to be doing many others unless you have a way to refuel. So I look upon that as sort of a much more difficult technical problem than just roving on the surface.
If we did reality base for a few minutes and didn't let our imaginations go wild, if we actually had a way to go to the moon and establish a lunar colony and tourists could go up there, would they be able to move around much? Would they be pretty limited to the area around the lunar base? Where would we be technology-wise, today and maybe for the next 5 to 10 years from today?
Well, if you were to return to the moon, you would probably be restricted very close to the outpost, to your main center of operations, at least for the foreseeable future. And the reason you would want to do that is you would want to build up enough infrastructure and capability and start harvesting water such that you would be able to support a fairly high level of activity. So you don't want to waste a lot of your efforts and energies going away from the base that you've taken so much difficulty to get to and establish. You want to basically establish that as a firm foothold that is well supplied, well established, it has supporting infrastructure, and expand that to support more people and more activity as time goes on. And that, to my mind, that's the initial goal of a lunar outpost or a lunar settlement. As more people come and as more product is made and as activities expand, you can move further and further away. So the trip that I described was a trip from the equator to the pole. So that's an enormous trip, and that would not occur until a fairly advanced level of activity on the moon is feasible.
Your first email question of the day comes from Don in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he says, as always, David, I'm listening at work, so I'm using email. Here is my question. Dr. Spudis, are you at all pleased with the progress being made by the private sector to return to the moon? I understand not much is being done on the public side for going to the moon, but people keep talking about the private sector will be able to get us back to the moon long before the public sector. Are you pleased with the progress that seems to be being made?
I'm not sure how much progress is actually being made. At the moment, it's commercial lunar flight is at a pretty low level of activity. Now, just by way of disclosure, I should say that I'm involved with one of the companies that's a competitor for the Google XPRIZE, and that would be Moon Express. But even if Moon Express is 100% successful, their primary mission is to make operative a couple of landers that can deliver, in the first case, about 50 kilograms soft-landed to the moon robotically, and in the case of the latter, about 10 times that, about 400 to 500 kilograms. Now, that sounds like a great deal of capability, and it is for science and for exploration and for engineering technology demonstrations. It is not a particularly high level of activity for things that people generally associate with lunar return, like people walking around on the moon or establishing a lunar outpost. And I don't know what some of the other companies are doing. I don't know where they are in their work plan, But I certainly know that no one is talking about sending very large spacecraft with very large capabilities to the lunar surface. So we do not have a lunar program as such. What we have are some people who are trying to establish a lunar capability, and the initial capability is going to be very small. It's going to be exclusively robotic. It's going to largely revolve around data acquisition, not gathering diamonds in the dust and not planting colonies or mining helium-3 or any of the things you always heard about. It's very much focused on doing the initial exploratory landings, a scope of operations very similar to what we saw with the Surveyor program in the mid-60s. So now that's non-trivial. I don't want to get you the idea that I think this is worthless. I don't. I mean, I wouldn't be involved with it if I did think that. I think it's an important step, and I'm very hopeful that it will be successful in it. But I don't want people to get the idea that because a few companies are competing for the Google Lunar X Prize, that means that we now have a return to the moon program. We do not.
What about humans on the moon? Are there any programs? I mean, we hear about Golden Spike, but we don't know very much about it.
We haven't heard anything from Golden Spike for the last couple of years, have we?
No.
I mean, like a lot of the new space companies, that they came out with a splash, got a lot of press coverage, had a lot of big media events, and we haven't heard anything since. So I was, at the time they announced, I was skeptical of their business model. I haven't seen anything that would make me change my mind on that.
What about other countries that may be more advanced or more willing to do a return to the moon with humans? Do you see any progress there?
Well, I think there is. I mean, clearly the Chinese have an interest in this. My understanding is they're getting ready to launch in the near future Chang'e 4, which is the fourth in their sequence of robotic lunar missions. It's certainly not a manned mission. However, their lander is quite large. Their lander is about a third to a half the size of a human lander, of the lander size you would need to land a human on the moon. This particular mission, Chang'e 4, is a lander, and it has a test rehearsal flight for a sample return, and that sample return mission will be Chang'e 5, which they plan to fly in sometime in the future, I would guess within the next 2 to 3 years. So they are flying Chang'e 4 to test out that sequence of events, very much like we flew Apollo 10 to kind of pave the way for the Apollo 11 landing that occurred 2 months later. Now, my understanding is they're getting ready to launch. I saw Leonard David had an article over the weekend that suggested they were going to launch this either this month or early next month. I don't quite recall what that article said. But that is a fairly significant step. They have shown that they have mastered the ability to fly at will throughout the various regions of cislunar space, including the lunar surface. So I think the Chinese program has shown both a good, solid engineering step-by-step approach. They're pursuing it methodically, and I see no reason why they will not eventually send people there.
Do they see and know something that we don't, or that we're ignoring or overlooking, or is their lunar program purely about their country wanting to achieve something and not so much about what may be on the moon or what the benefits of doing this may be?
I think it's a little of both of that. It's a closed society, so we don't know as much about their program as we do about our own. However, I think there's both the desire to show the world that they are a first world country. So there is that. I mean, that is a motivator anytime you're dealing with new space programs. They want to demonstrate they're as good as any other nation that's done it so far. However, I think if you look in detail at the activities that the Chinese have done, that what their series of missions have accomplished, the aims of their missions and the order in which they have flown, to me suggests something a little more subtle and a great deal more significant is in their minds, and that is the idea of cislunar space control. What I mean by that is that not so much that, you know, we control space and we'll decide who goes and who stays, but rather it's the ability to routinely move capability anywhere in the volume of space between Earth and Moon that you may need it. And what the Chinese have done, they have developed a system of spacecraft and individual pieces that have shown the ability to go from low Earth orbit to translunar injection to lunar orbit to the lunar surface, out of lunar orbit to the libration points, the L points, and then into circumsolar space. Now, that ability to maneuver spacecraft and to loiter in these various places and then to leave them and go to a different place to accomplish different missions, those are all the requirements you need to develop a cislunar space control capability. And what I mean by that is the ability to go to any point in this volume of space and either emplace an asset or deny an asset to a potential adversary. So that could mean going up, for example, rendezvousing with a satellite in geosynchronous orbit and disabling it. Or it could mean approaching a satellite in space that has important national security dimensions from a direction that would be unexpected, and thus the situational awareness of that earlier asset isn't able to recognize the approach. All of these things are part of their cislunar capability. Now, I would be flabbergasted if no one in China has realized this. I don't believe that. They're as smart as we are. They see the value in this. And so when you ask what their aim is, it's partly the prestige thing. It's partly the public relations splash. But it's also the fact that they, unlike us, recognize that cislunar space is a strategic theater that's of extreme importance. And I think they are systematically developing the capability to move routinely through it.
Do you think that we really don't recognize this, or we've just downplayed it as a really minor priority, if it's even a priority?
Some people recognize it. Not everyone is brain dead in the government. Some people do recognize what I'm talking about, and they do understand that developing that capability is important. They may have different ideas on how to develop that capability, and we seem to be locked into the paradigm in our civil space program of ever increasing and ever bigger and ever more pointless stunt missions. Whereas I think to approach it from the Chinese perspective what I think they're trying to do, you need to look at it from a different paradigm. You need to approach it as a Lego model where you're building pieces that incrementally and gradually extend your reach and capability outward. That's the difference, and no one can argue that we're doing the latter now. We should be doing it, but we're not doing it.
Ever-increasing stunt missions, is that an apt description of our space program?
Well, I mean, what do you call the asteroid retrieval mission? It is a stunt. It's devised primarily to cover the embarrassment of the fact that we're going to have a CEV, we're going to have an Orion spacecraft flying, and we've got no place to send it because the moon's been put off the table. There's nothing at the Lagrangian points. So what they've decided to do is to drag a rock to orbit around the moon and then rendezvous with it. And the fact is it's not going to accomplish anything of any great significance. We already have samples of near-Earth asteroids. As they're called meteorites. We've got tons of them. You're not going to learn anything about the origin of the solar system from it. You're not really going to learn anything about the physical makeup of asteroids as a possible knowledge base for future planetary defense, because you can't bring a projectile or a bolide big enough back to lunar orbit to really study it and understand the dimensions of the problem. So all you'll have is a chunk of asteroid. And the fact is that the Orion is really not configured for long-duration proximity operations with EVA of human crews. Every time the guys are going to go out to look at this, they're going to have to depressurize the whole spacecraft. So it's very much like the old Gemini EVAs. It's nothing like the shuttle or space station EVAs, which have an airlock. Now, I've seen different incarnations where they're talking about making this more complicated, where they've got a habitation module, which will have an airlock. But initially, anyway, they're talking about a very simple, stripped-down mission to no real benefit that I can see. So, yeah, it's a stunt. It's a stunt because they came up with it because they were embarrassed. They didn't have any place to send the Orion.
Of course, I don't think that it'll ever become a real mission. So,
well, that's another argument. But I mean, right now it is the mission. Right now, that is what we're going to do with the Orion spacecraft. And but even worse than that, I mean, this talk about Mars missions and especially Mars missions within timescales of less than a couple of decades at least. It simply isn't going to happen. Even the Mars, which one is the Dennis Tito idea, the flyby? What's that called?
Inspiration Mars.
Inspiration Mars. Even that, I think, is, and I was kind of amazed to see people whose opinions I respect endorse that. I think that's one of the ultimate stunts, because you think about it, you're going to be in space for over a year, for effectively a day flyby of Mars, and you're not really going to get a very good view of it.
One
of the things people forget about Mars is that it's a very low-contrast object. The reason the pictures that you see returned by all the orbital spacecraft look so good is that their contrast has been enhanced by image processing, and they've got these vivid colors and these beautiful blacks and dramatic contrasts and shadows. But when you look at Mars, and if you don't believe me, just look at get a telescope and look at it. It's a pretty featureless disk, and the reason it is because the atmosphere is filled with this suspended dust, and that just basically makes everything appear the same kind of reddish brownish hue, and it's not particularly interesting to look at even with the naked eye. I just have a feeling it's a long way for very, very little.
Well, I think they also fly by it at night, so whether that makes a big difference or not, I don't know.
Well, it helps a little bit because the contrast is going to be enhanced along the terminator. So as you fly by the sunlit side, you'll see cast shadows, and that'll be dramatic. I mean, you know how cast shadows look on the moon. They're very dramatic. That increases the contrast. But, again, that doesn't really do much for me in any event. It's just a long trip for very little return.
Do you see our near-term policy changing anytime soon to anything that you would like to support?
Regrettably, I do not. I mean, it's every time NASA is asked about, are you sure you guys are doing the right thing, they dig their heels in, and the same with the White House, and they're not interested in reevaluating their thought process or anything else. I don't see that changing. And what's more, I have to say that I'm not sure that things will necessarily get better with a new administration either, because now we have this NRC report. And there's a lot of good stuff in it, but at the same time, I think there's a fundamental flaw in it. And the fundamental flaw is that it recognizes only scientific exploration as the rationale for sending people into space. And while I'm a scientist and I love that and I support that and want that to happen, that is not a sufficient rationale to support a multi-billion-dollar program over the course of multiple decades. So you know, if you read that report and the NRC report, and I'm talking about the opening chapter, which basically talks about the Horizon Goal. It says the Horizon Goal is Mars. And the reason the Horizon Goal is Mars is because they're answering two questions which they pose to themselves. The questions are, how far can humans go and what can they do when they get there? And effectively, I think that's the wrong question. It's the wrong set of questions to set up as a predicate for what follows. What they should have asked is, why do we want to go into space, and what are we trying to accomplish? And they didn't look at it from that perspective. So therefore, if you look at it from the way they did, you end up with the answer is it's all exploration oriented. It's all science. How far can people go? How far into the unknown can we go? Which when you think about it, that's kind of a trivial question. Okay, I mean, who cares how far we can go? If my goal field is in the next county, why would I want to go overseas? Okay, they did not address that question. They didn't address the whole issue of space applications and utilization, and that is so because of their perspective that it was driven by the desire to go far and to do great things when we get there, to explore the unknown. They didn't think about, well, what could we do in cislunar space with people that would actually help create wealth, that would create capability, that would give us new kinds of things to do and new capabilities that we don't have now, that we could have if we had an incremental program that built things up in cislunar space first. That was totally blown over. And to my mind, I think that's the answer. If people are looking for a reason of why do we have human spaceflight, we have human spaceflight to do things that humans are needed for. And one of the things we found out in the last 30 years is that humans are needed to build big distributed systems and to fix things when they break. So the third thing they're needed for is to make scientific discoveries. But just considering the utilization aspects first, I think that's a proven fact. It can't really be gainsaid. You can say, well, it's not worth it, or we could do it with machines. None of those are really true. I mean, we built the International Space Station through assembly. We made it work. It's the biggest spacecraft ever built. It's 1 million pounds in LEO. And if you imagine having something like that at geosynchronous orbit as a communications station, I mean, you could effectively render the entire terrestrial cell phone network obsolete in a single fell swoop. So, I mean, and that potentially is worth literally trillions of dollars. Now, none of that was considered by this committee, so I think they missed the ball on that. I was very disappointed, and it's not like they didn't hear about it. I mean, they had presentations, they invited presentations, they invited public submissions. A lot of people submitted things to that. I was one of them. And a lot of others, too. It wasn't just me suggesting this. Others suggested very similar things, and that did not really feature prominently in the report at all.
Now, as I recall, the report also says that if we're not going to the surface of Mars, what's the point of doing any of this?
Well, that's exactly right, and I think that's an amazingly blinkered and philistine attitude.
Very narrow. Here, I got another email question for you from Bijan, who's listening in Sweden. And he says, how and when, I mean, you've kind of been answering this, but this will be more specific. How and when do you predict that the next human lunar landing will happen? What components are missing today? For example, maybe a lunar landing and ascent stage for the Dragon spacecraft, Bijan in Sweden.
Well, like I say, I think the next human landing will be by the Chinese. And we have not seen their spacecraft designs yet. We can kind of guess what they're going to look like. I suspect they will somehow resemble the Soviet hardware of the 1960s. There was a lunar Soyuz and a lunar landing cabin that was part of that architecture. They're on display in museums in Moscow. Now, I'm told, I haven't been there, but I've seen pictures of them. And they look very much like since the Chinese orbital manned spacecraft looks like a Soyuz, I suspect their lunar spacecraft will look similarly. I don't know exactly how they're going to do this. I don't know if they're going to build a much bigger booster, or if they're going to launch this using several different launches of the Long March. I don't know exactly what their plan is. They haven't revealed their architecture. But the next people to stand on the moon will probably be Chinese. That's my guess.
Bijan and lots of other space advocates, space enthusiasts, make the same assumption, and that is that the lunar landing is going to be using a Dragon spacecraft. Any thoughts on that? Other than the Chinese?
I have no reaction to that because there is no Dragon spacecraft. Nothing's flown yet.
Well, we've seen
a mock-up, but we haven't seen any flights of it. And so it's a big step going from an Earth orbital vehicle, which hasn't even flown yet, to modifying and developing that into a lunar lander, and that has not. I think that's a long way in the future.
So you're not counting it as reality already?
Not yet. I mean, I'm perfectly willing to count it as reality if they show me some reality.
Well, they're not there yet.
No, they're not. And this is actually brings this up into another point, because one of the things that you asked what I've written lately, and one of the things I wrote was a blog back at the end of last month on space policy, and I was taking note of the 10th anniversary of the winning of the Ansari X Prize. That was in October of 2004.
Yeah, I was actually going to bring that up on the second segment, but let's do it now.
Well, we can wait on that.
No, go ahead. You brought it up, so let's talk about it now.
Well, I was there. I was at the Mojave Spaceport that day, and I saw it, and it was great, and I really enjoyed it. It was quite a spectacle. And we were a little concerned as we were watching. I was watching through binoculars, and I saw that he was in a pretty fast roll during the ascent, and I was getting a little concerned. It turned out that wasn't much of a problem. At least afterwards, the pilot said it wasn't an issue. And the prize was won. They launched that day, and then they launched, I think, a week later, and they won the X Prize. And that was 10 years ago, and we have yet to see a single commercial human space flight in a decade.
We don't have an operational vehicle yet.
Well, that's my point. And remember, the point of prizes, the people that advocate prizes say that if you offer a prize, that it's not just that people want to win the prize, that the number of people striving to win the prize advance technology in great leaps that you couldn't achieve if you were just systematically pursuing a direction. So the whole point of and Newt Gingrich is famous for making this argument. He says, well, we don't need a government space program. Let's just offer a prize, and we'll get all the space flight we can handle. And the fact is, that doesn't work. I mean, it hasn't worked with human space flight yet, anyway. We're still waiting for the first human space flight. I remember back in another thing happened 10 years ago, and that was I wrote another blog post on this, and that was the Aldrich Report, which I was involved in. And I can't remember exactly when this happened. At some point, either in the writing of the report or in one of our press conferences or in the rollout of this thing, someone made the comment that, and at least this was attributed to the commission. I certainly don't disagree with it. I don't remember us saying it. But the point, someone had made the point that we had claimed that human space flight was a government activity for the foreseeable future. And I got ripped to shreds on this, and including by one of your guests, past guests. I won't mention his name, but he just took every opportunity he ever had to basically tear me a new one for daring to say such a patently offensive and obviously stupid assertion.
Do you remember the guest?
I do.
Oh, yeah,
I won't mention his name.
Well,
I do remember. I'll tell you at the break.
Tell me at the break.
but I got to say, it's 10 years now, and I don't consider the predictive horizon to be much greater than a decade. It's more like 5 years, but I'll take 10. I'm happy with that. And here it is, 10 years, and we have yet to see a single commercial human spaceflight. So guess who is right?
But we're getting close. Does that count?
We've been getting close for the last 20 years.
I'm kidding, but I mean it's always 2 years away. But now
it's like nuclear fusion power, right? It's always a decade away.
So, but now it may be down from 2 years to about 1 year away to sometime in 2015, maybe.
Okay. You know, I mean, look, what can I say? What struck me was not, and look, I understand that there's a reason for it. I'm not dumping on these guys. I mean, I understand they have problems. I understand they're working through them.
And it is a challenge. There's no doubt about it.
It's a challenge.
Yeah.
And I don't disparage that. They're trying to do something that's difficult, and I understand that it's difficult. But at the same time, I don't think it does our community any good to live in a fantasy world where we're imagining capabilities and spacecraft and things that don't yet exist. And now you can say, well, Spudish, you did that with your trip across the moon. But I labeled that
you
as a fantasy.
You labeled it as a fantasy.
All right? I didn't say you could do this next week. I said you could do it sometime in the next 50 to 60 years. But at the same time, when you're talking about a real space program and real capabilities, I think it behooves us to keep our feet on the ground while our heads are above the clouds, and of all the dumb things you can do, the dumbest is to fool yourself.
Well, space advocacy is heavily driven by fantasy, although when you call people on it, they're not part of the fantasy. As
of
always,
course,
you know, that's the way it works. Here, I got a follow-up email from Bijan over there in across the pond. It is sometimes argued that lunar missions would be stepping stones to Mars, but aren't the differences too large in terms of distance, length of night, temperature variations, gravity, atmosphere, dust, in situ resources? could the same type of landers, communication systems, power sources, rovers, or spacesuits really be used on both the Moon and Mars?
Partly, yes, they could. He's right. They're two different objects. They have different environments. They're different travel times, different chemical compositions. All that's true. But at the same time, there's a lot in common with the two mission profiles. They both leave low Earth orbit. They enter the gravity field of another planet. You operate with vehicles that descend and land. You'll rendezvous and dock. You'll do all those things at a distance that's very far from the Earth, so you have to kind of master a certain degree of autonomy. You have to interact with the planetary surface. Granular material has to be processed to extract resources. You're in a fractional gravity. You have to deal with dust. You have to deal with radiation. You have to deal with heat. You have to deal with cold. All those things are in common. The magnitude of the challenges and the differences are different because they're different environments. But at the same time, you're talking about modifications of a system, not totally new, wholly new and different systems. So it is true that you don't have to go to the Moon to go to Mars. On the other hand, most responsible engineers that I know and that I've talked to think that it is foolish to think about going to Mars without practicing some of these things on the Moon. And it's just a prudent step that makes sense from a lot of different perspectives. So, yes, I agree. There are different places, and we need to design different approaches to handle the differences. But at the same time, there's a lot of commonality as well.
Paul is in upstate New York, and Paul says, Dr. Spudas, is there anything in current time, 2014, 2015, that shows that we are ready to capitalize on cislunar commercial development? Is that even too immature for us now?
Well, it's a matter of how you want to define that term, cislunar commercial development. One could argue that we've already started it. I mean, certainly the communication satellite constellation, which are operated by a consortium of industries and countries, are using cislunar space, and that's a cislunar space application. And the same way with the GPS constellation and with weather satellites. So in a way, we're already doing it. I'm advocating effectively what is not something different, but something that's the next step. The next step is to make bigger and more distributed and reusable and extensible systems that can be maintained and built and increased in capability with time as technology improves via the mechanism of being able to visit them and upgrade them in place. So what that requires is a transportation system to get people and machines from LEO to the various spots in cislunar that they are needed. And that's mostly geosynchronous orbit. It also has a few other orbits that are much higher than LEO. And that requires a transportation system that can leave low Earth orbit, that can go effectively to the Moon, because to get to GEO is the same energy it takes to get to the Moon. And hopefully to have the ability to refuel our system so that we can reuse rockets in stages, and that requires the development of a fueling depot at the lunar poles. Now, that's what I'm talking about when I talk about cislunar development. It's not a revolution. It's an evolution. It's moving the next step beyond what we have now, which is that we launch all of these assets singly, piecemeal, from Earth to one in which we move pieces around and build them incrementally like Lego blocks in space. So we have in-space assembly, in-space servicing, in-space expansion.
But Paul, if we use the term commercial, and we mean commercial, that means someplace along the line, companies are doing this to make a profit. Are we ready to do that yet, or does this need to be government-seeded?
Well, no, I don't think we're ready to do it yet as a strictly commercial enterprise, and that's why I advocate making what I'm proposing sort of the centerpiece of the U.S. civil space program. One of the things that we've always done in the civil space program is to pave the way for commercialization later. So the government does what commercial entities cannot afford to do at the present. They mitigate risk by demonstrating capabilities and developing technologies. So a technology and a capability to build the kind of system I'm talking about that's refuelable through the harvesting of lunar ice, that's something that, frankly, I don't think the commercial sector is capable of pulling off. Now, others would disagree with this, that there are companies that want to do this. But to my mind, it seems to be a really good challenge and a task for our government civil space program to pick up, not to commercialize the moon, but to determine and to answer the question, to determine the answer to the question, can the moon be commercialized? Can it be industrialized? And that means going to the moon, understanding what the form of the lunar volatiles are. Can we get at them? Can we extract them? Can we ship them away from the moon into space where they might be needed? That's the mission. That's the goal. That's what will give us not only the capability to go throughout cislunar space, but also ultimately the capability of the planets as well. So that's what I'm talking about. It's government and commercial, but commercial following the lead of the government.
So in Congress, and we've got a Department of Commerce, so let's not forget that. But in Congress, you've got on the House and the Senate side all these committees that have commercial something or other in their name. And, you know, they all, you know, claim that they have a commitment to refining or improving or facilitating something commercial that falls within the realm of their committee's, you know, direction. Why does space consistently evade this? Even among the committees that deal with space science, technology, I'm not hearing this kind of talk coming from any of these committees, and Congress is controlling the purse strings to NASA. And
no, you're right, and it's a new idea in a way. I mean, you know, it wasn't until the last couple of years that we knew for certain that there was enough water on the moon, at the poles of the moon, to support the kind of thing I'm talking about. I mean, remember, we had a 20-year debate starting in the mid-90s on whether the original Clementine observation was a false reading or not. Were we seeing ice or were we seeing something else? And that scientific debate went on for years, and it wasn't until we had the recent spate of lunar spacecraft, including the Indian Chandrayaan-1 and L-Cross and LRO and all these orbiters from all the and Selene from Japan. All these lunar missions have shown us that the moon has the resources that we need to do this. So in part, it's a new idea. So it hasn't sunk in to people's consciousnesses yet. They haven't yet realized the real significance of the fact that there's a lot of water on the moon. So what I'm trying to do is to publicize this idea to the extent I can. I'm trying to tell as many people on the Hill about it as I can. In some cases, I've gotten blank stares, and in other cases, they get it immediately. They see the value, and so it's a mixed reaction. It's the same reaction I get when I talk to the public at large. You know, some people say, "Well, who cares about ice and the moon? What's the difference?" And others just think it's the coolest thing since sliced bread. And so it's a new idea. It's going to take a while before its true significance is fully appreciated. I think that we're making progress. I am not discouraged in that respect at all. I think we are making progress on that front. We're showing people that a future in space different, a paradigm of operation different than what we've had in the past is possible. And most people I've talked to about that are quite excited.
We're going to take our break. We are halfway, and I'm going to find the forbidden information out. So, listeners, hopefully you'll get away from using email and you will give us a call and talk to Dr. Spudas. 1-866-687-7223. Email, of course, drspace@thespaceshow.com. We'll be back in about 3 minutes. Don't go anyplace.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. It is part two of our Monday program. Dr. Paul Spudas is our guest today. And I learned so much talking to the guests during the break. It's too bad that I can't make those conversations public. But I learned a new term today, listeners, and I'm not taking credit for it, but I am going to use it. It is called Internet Rocketeer. And you will hear me use this quite a bit on future space show programs. In fact, I know who the author of that term is, and I'm going to invite him back on the show. It's been about a year since Mark has been on the show, and I'm sure he'll be happy to return. Before we do the order of business that you want to do, Paul, let me get Bijan's email out of the way because he sent us a note during the break. Do you think that the secretive X-37B corresponds to the current Chinese-like cislunar capability, or that it is about to evolve into that?
Probably not. We don't know a lot about that vehicle, but as near as I can tell, it is strictly a low-Earth orbit vehicle. I don't think it has the capability to go into cislunar. Yeah, into cislunar trans, basically to GEO and beyond. However, it is that kind of capability I'm talking about. We don't really know much about what the mission of this vehicle is, what sensors it carries, or what activities it undertakes. It's probably undertaking a variety of different tasks. It's probably adaptable. They can change out instruments to do different things. It lands like the shuttle did on Earth, and then it gets relaunched and reused, refueled, refurbished. But that's the kind of direction I think you want to go. I mean, but only space-based, all right? The shuttle did essentially this, and the problem the shuttle had was not that it did its job poorly. It actually did its job superbly. The problem was it was very expensive. That capability came at a great price. It looks like the X-37B is something that is turned around. We don't know the details of its budget, but I would suspect it's a fraction of what it cost the shuttle to operate. And so that's a good thing, and maybe that will spill over into the civil area and the commercial area at some time in the future. But in effect, in a very rudimentary sense, that is sort of the kind of capability I'm talking about.
But you know, given all the national security leaks we have had over the last dozen years or so, I'm really impressed that they're keeping this as still a secret vehicle, and it's not.
Well, the Russians probably know more about it than you and I do.
Oh, I'm sure from that perspective.
But, you know, all we know is what we read in the papers. But they have succeeded in keeping a lid on this, and yeah, that is impressive.
That is impressive that it hasn't been leaked out to the public yet. You were talking during the break, and I got the same email from our friend Bill Melberg that you got. Why don't you tell us about this individual that we're talking about and his accomplishments and the essence of what Bill sent out to us?
Sure. Today is actually a very special day. It's the 100th birthday of a man named James Charles Floyd. And I do not know this gentleman. My friend Bill Melberg knows him. But he was the chief engineer of Canada's Avro Aero program in the 1950s. The Aero was a jet interceptor that was a really high-performing aircraft. It was a superb piece of machinery, and it was built by a Canadian engineering team in the late 1950s. And then it was canceled just as it was finished and finalized. All the bugs were worked out, and the government pulled the plug on it, and it left about 100 engineers, including James Floyd, out of work. Now, that was a tragedy for them, but it was actually a great benefit to the United States, because at the same time they lost their jobs, there was a guy named Robert Gilruth who led a group from Langley, which is in Hampton, Virginia, called the Space Task Group, and they had just been given the job of building first the Mercury spacecraft, which was to send a single man into orbit, and then, of course, ultimately the Apollo program, which was to send men to the moon. A lot of the engineers who worked on the Aero came across the border and came to work for NASA, and their contributions were critical. I did not know anything about this story until I read a superb book, and I strongly recommend this book to all of your listeners. It's by a guy named Charles Murray, who wrote a book with his wife, Catherine Cox, and the book is called Apollo, The Race to the Moon. This was published back in, I think, on the 20th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission back in 89. It's still in print. You can get a paperback of it. You can get it at Amazon. And that story of the Canadians and the Aero Canadian engineers and their contributions to NASA, they were critical in the early stages of formulating manned spaceflight in this country. And James Floyd was the chief engineer of that effort. Now, he did not come and work on Apollo. It turned out he's English. He went back to Britain. However, he was involved in the Concorde, the British supersonic transport that has just recently retired. So it's his 100th birthday. I just wanted to wish him a happy birthday and thank you for your contributions to the opening of space.
Absolutely. And I've done a lot of shows on the Aero and the croup coming down here. And Apogee has printed several books on it, and I've had their authors on the show. So
yeah, there's a very good book called Aeros to the Moon, Avro's Engineers in the Space Race by a guy named Chris Gaynor. And that's an Apogee book, and that's the whole story is laid out there in detail.
Absolutely. So if you're not familiar with it, you know, and one of the reasons they canceled this program, they thought that the program was so rift with Soviet Union espionage in Canada that it couldn't be trusted or couldn't be saved. And Diepenbacher in their parliament canceled the program.
That's right, and we tend to forget that. There was a very big scandal around that time. There was the Pinkovsky scandal,
right?
And of course, it was also revealed in that era, in the late 50s and early 60s, that British intelligence had been thoroughly penetrated by the Soviet Union, and so there was a lot of paranoia, and it was entirely justified paranoia at that time.
I have a note from Harry in Tucson for you. David, I'm also at work. Paul, I'm looking at your blog, and I read your October 15th article on Follies, and I know you talked about this a little bit in the first segment, but you went through all of these government space reports that are supposed to tell us something and help us build on the future going back to who knows when. And yet, when you look at all of them lined up and analyzed, as you have shown us, what do they really accomplish? Are they worth the taxpayers' money? Could we be doing something better than convening a panel or doing another study?
Well, that's a good question. I'm tempted to answer a question like that with saying, you know, when someone asks, well, what's their real value, and is to be cynical and say nothing at all. But that's not quite true. They do have value in the following sense. It is a way for a subgroup of the community as a whole to put down on paper their strategic thoughts, such as they are. And by writing those out, that helps to organize and collate your thinking. It may not be the ultimate answer. You may not fully understand the magnitudes and the dimension of a problem. But by writing these reports and going through the process of gathering information, of holding meetings, of having committee meetings, of group writings and revisions and edits and external review and all the stuff that we go through, and it's painful. Don't get me wrong. It's an incredible pain. But at least it makes you think through the problem. So you may not know all the answers that you need to know, but at least you know some of the answers. So, and that has value. I mean, it's not a worthless exercise to sit down and try to figure out what exactly are you trying to do and what's the best way to approach that. Now, all three of these reports do that to some extent. Now, each of them were given a slightly different charter, and I tried to explain what those charters were in the blog post. And they answered the terms of their charters as best they could. In some cases, I think there were significant opportunities missed. In others, the very structure of the committee and its terms of reference was loaded. So it was preloaded such that an answer would come out that was desired rather than an objective evaluation. And in some, I'm infuriated by the narrow parochialism of it. But having said that, I recognize that it's a flawed process because we're all flawed humans. Nobody's perfect, and everybody does the best job with what they're given. And what I tried to show in this, the reason I wrote this was not to dump on the reports. It's easy to do, and it's very easy to dump on whatever effort someone tries to make in this. What I was trying to point out was that each report was constructed and crafted with the aim of helping the program, and in each case, it had the opposite effect. Now, if you want to conclude from that we shouldn't do these reports, that is a possible conclusion. That's not my conclusion. What I was trying to show was that sometimes when you get involved in these efforts, that the unintended side effects are more important than what you think you're doing. Sometimes you're not solving the problem you think you're solving, or you're either you're making a problem worse, you're exacerbating its effect, or you're solving a totally different problem, or you're answering a question that nobody asked. And it's a tricky business, this committee commission thing. Oh, I also tried to I tried to figure out was there a difference between the three groups. And interestingly enough, there was a lessening of the bureaucratic hierarchy with each one. I mean, the first one was a presidential commission, and that we all had our commissions personally signed by the President of the United States. Mine's hanging over here on the wall. I'm looking at it right now in my office at home. The next one was the NASA administrator picked the committee members. And the last one, they were picked by the mysterious and ever unknown processes that occur at the National Research Council. I've been on NRC panels in the past. I have no idea how they pick their members. But in any event, there was a definite decline in bureaucratic pecking order as we went through this in time. And yet, in terms of the scope of responsibility, it increased through time. So, for example, we were asked, the first commission, the Aldrich Commission, was asked a very narrow question, and that is, how do we implement President Bush's vision for space exploration? The second committee, the Augustine Group, was asked, is the current state of the human spaceflight program, is it in good shape, and what should we be doing if it's not? Are we doing the right goals? The last one was the broadest of all. You know, why do we have a human spaceflight program, and where should we go, and what should we do? It was the broadest of all. And consequently, there's an increase in the verbiage of each report. The first one is the shortest. I think it's like 70 pages or so. The next one is like 150. And the latest thing is almost 300 pages long. So I have no doubt the next one will ask about the origin and fate of the universe, and it will be at least 1,000 pages long. And it will be appointed by some guy down on the street. I'm just extrapolating from the evidence of these three.
Or it may be appointed by somebody in the Chinese space program.
Well, no doubt they have their own process. I very much doubt that it's like this.
It could be worse. You know,
You never know about a closed society. I mean, they may go into a room and the guy whose idea is not picked gets shot.
Do you think space advocacy influences these studies at all?
It does, and in some cases to their detriment. I do think they have an influence. Each one of these reports asked for external input through a variety of mechanisms. And in some cases, it was public meetings. In some cases, it was asking for written submissions. Some of them had open microphone where you could go to a public meeting and make your harangue in public. And some conducted polling. I mean, everything in the book was picked. And in some cases, it was a good input, and in some cases, it was not so good. So it's a mixed bag. And it's just like the report itself. There's good and bad in each one of these.
If you want to try to impact space policy and set a path for us for the future, for human spaceflight, let's leave the science and the rovers aside for a minute. It seems to me you get a study to endorse what it is you want to do or where you want to go, right? And then you try to breathe some life into that to make at least some of it become policy, but obviously that doesn't work. I don't think anyone believes that the pathway study is going to become our human spaceflight policy.
No, you at best, all you can do is hope to make a logical case that the policymakers will embrace at some level. That's the most you can hope for. And if you're asking, what can the average guy in the street do to influence policy? Well, the answer is not very much. You can vote is the one thing you have. That is a tool, and that's something. And you can advocate. And you can write articles. You can write books. You can do public speaking. You can do all those things that I do and that you do and we all do. And of course, that has a limited impact. And that's inevitable. That's the way it is. But, I think that there are things, ideas, good ideas take on a life of their own. If an idea has merit, if there's something about an idea that makes sense or strikes a chord in people, it won't die, right? It'll grow. People will pick up on it. They'll repeat it to their friends. It'll gain momentum. And so it's only the totally worthless ideas that go away and are ignored forever. A good idea will be around. Unfortunately, that's true for some bad ideas as well. But that's just the nature of our society. We try to advocate what we support and what we think is the right thing, and sometimes we win and sometimes we lose.
But, many people that I get to talk to, both the guests as well as listeners, are really frustrated that so little is happening. And it doesn't matter whether, they think Mars One is the best thing since lemon pie to go to one-way Mars trips, or whether it's cislunar or return to the moon or even the ARM mission. But none of this ever seems to get put into action. I always ask people when they're advocating this, that, or the other, I ask them, what's your plan to breathe life into your idea to turn it into an actionable policy? And, there's a big dead silence because nobody seems to have a plan for implementing what it is that they think we should be doing.
Well, let me tell you a story.
Okay, please do. Make it a good one.
And this may not be strictly relevant to the current circumstances, but there are elements of it. About 15 years ago, I was a scientist here at the LPI in Houston, and I kept in contact with the then center director, George Abbey. I knew George Abbey from being on the Stafford Commission with him. That was the SEI commission back in the early 1990s that looked at how to implement the SEI. I've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
And George was the center director at JSC, and he would occasionally call me and ask me to do a favor, give a talk on the moon to some group of his, or help some students and give them a presentation, which I was happy to do. And I was talking to him one day, and John Young was in the office. John was his deputy. And so John and George and I were talking about the direction of NASA. And I said, you know, I said, you guys should think about looking at space differently. We have some evidence that there's water on the moon. This was after Lunar Prospector and after Clementine. It was still argued about, but it was pretty clear that something strange was going on at the poles. And I said, but more than that, what we found, and I had done some research at the LPI with a postdoc of mine, Ben Bussey, we had looked at the lighting conditions at the poles, and we had found areas near the poles that were in nearly constant illumination. This was really a significant finding, and the reason is, in fact, it's more significant than the water, because what permanent light on the moon means is that you can stay on the moon indefinitely. The big killer with building lunar base in the SEI days, everybody, we were always looking at an equatorial landing site, an equatorial base, and that meant you had to survive a 14-day nighttime, which was not only there was no sun to generate power, but it was extremely cold, and that drove you to needing a nuclear reactor on the surface, and that drove the cost up by several orders of magnitude. So effectively, it made lunar return unaffordable, strictly because of the requirements of having to survive this nighttime. Now we found a spot near the poles where you're in permanent sunlight. So it's not only do you have permanent solar power, but you have a benign thermal environment, too. It never gets very hot and never gets very cold. You can control the temperature of things with a system of shades and louvers. So it actually makes your thermal control problem a lot better. Now, they got real excited by this, and so they said, why don't you make up a presentation and come back and give it to people around here? And I started doing that, and then George got pushed out. The next guy that was the head of JSC was a guy named Howell, General Howell, and I went to brief him about this one time. John Young invited me over and introduced us, and I gave him the spiel, and he said, you know, this is really neat. He says, I want you to brief all my senior people. So I did that, and he invited all his heads of department in, and I gave them a talk on the value of the moon and why it should be the next thing for NASA to do. Now, remember, in 2000 and 2001, there was no intent to go to the moon, right? There was no intent to do anything, really. Everybody was focused on getting space station built, but the more seasoned hands were starting to think beyond that. They're saying, okay, station's going to be finished. Shuttle is nearing the end of its service lifetime. What are we going to do next? And, of course, everyone was pushing for Mars. The Mars guys were as loud as then as they are now. But they're just that wasn't supportable. It wasn't supportable from a budgetary point of view. And so I had my little canned speech. I called it my stump speech. And it got peddled all the way up the chain of command. I went first to see at headquarters, I went to see Kathy Sullivan, who was the chief scientist of the agency at the time, and I gave her the spiel. And then I went to see, who was next? It was somebody fairly high up. I'm sorry, my mind's a blank, but it was someone on the ninth floor at NASA headquarters.
So you were thinking that you were making progress through all of this, I assume.
I was. So I even moved back to Washington, D.C., because I thought if I'm closer to the center of power, I'll be able to have a better influence. And then we had Columbia. And, of course, that shut the space program dead. I just shut it down completely while the Columbia Accident Investigation Board did its work. But at the same time, I was hearing rumors that there was a major review of the goals of the U.S. space program. And I met a guy at a meeting, and his name was Klaus Heiss. I don't know if you ever had Klaus on the program or not.
No, I have not.
Klaus was an interesting guy. He had done some of the original analyses of the economics of the shuttle. And it was his work at a contractor group called Mathematica that basically told NASA how often it would have to fly the shuttle to make it a profit-making activity, and it turned out to be like once every 2 weeks. Now, that was misinterpreted as saying that Klaus said that was going to happen. He did not. They asked him a question, how often would we have to fly it, and he told them. But at the same time, he was an economist. He was not an engineer, but he knew a lot of engineering, and he contacted me. I did not know him. He contacted me and said, you know, there's a major review going on. I think you're going to be really interested in it. And I said, that's nice, and I kind of forgot about it. Now, this was in the fall of 2003, okay? So this was about 9 months after Columbia. Then a bunch of things happened in rapid succession, and this was really weird. First, I got a call from a guy named Tom Rogers. Tom Rogers was a giant in the early space program.
I knew Tom well.
He actually helped develop the Atlas ICBM, and he called me totally out of the blue. He says, "Yeah, I've been reading your book, The Once and Future Moon. I really like this idea of going back to the moon and using the moon." He says, "Would you be interested in coming and telling Sam Brownback's committee about this?" And Sam Brownback was the senator from Kansas. He was the chair of the Senate Space Subcommittee. And I said, "Yeah, I'll be glad to," which I did. And then there was a conference in Washington, D.C. in December that Bob Zubrin went to as well, because Bob and I were both there, that Buzz convened, and it was about the future direction of the space program. Now, at that meeting, there was a big rumor that we're coming up on the 100th anniversary of the Wright brothers' flight, and there was a big rumor that President Bush was going to make an announcement at that celebration in Kitty Hawk, and the announcement was going to be a lunar return. Now, that was a rumor at that stage. And, of course, the Kitty Hawk thing came and went, and nothing about it at all. And so Zubrin, I love this, he wrote this op-ed in the Washington Times crowing that, you know, he had defeated this stupid plan to return to the moon that Bush was going to announce. He was going to announce it, and then through Bob's brilliance, he came to his senses and he didn't want to make a fool of himself in public, so that's gone away, so don't worry about it anymore. It was quite amusing. And then, of course, what happened was there was actually a review at the White House in mid-December on a decision on whether to proceed with the VSE or not. And the decision was to do it. And 2 weeks later, President Bush went to NASA headquarters and made the announcement. Now, for the time between January 2004 until it was terminated by Obama in April of 2010, that's 6 years, we had a strategic direction for the space program. We knew where we were going. We knew what the schedule was, approximately. We roughly knew the way we were going to do this, the architecture we were going to use. And I'm not going to take credit for doing that, all right? But I'm saying I was one voice among many that were saying, look, it makes sense as a next step to go to the moon. And we were making that case to Congress, we were making it in the media, and we were making it to people in the space agency and across the town of Washington. And somebody was listening, because this thing didn't come out of nowhere. And I got to meet, at a later date, Jack Marburger, who was the head of OSTP. He was President Bush's science advisor. A great guy, and really sharp, and very imaginative. And he was concerned, this was early in the implementation of the VSE, he was concerned that people were losing sight of the real purpose. He thought the real purpose of the vision was to actually change the rules of spaceflight. He was a very big thinker. He said, you know, this whole idea of putting something on a rocket and launching it, you throw away the rocket, you throw away the spacecraft, you get the data, you move on to the next one. He says, we've got to move away from that. We've got to move away to a system of permanence where we're using what we find in space to create new capability, which was a gospel that I embraced, of course. And he went and gave a speech, and this, you can find this online. I've got it linked at my site, to the Goddard Symposium in 2006. That is probably one of the best articulations of what the original idea behind the VSE was. And he said, it basically, Marburger summed it up in one question. He says, the question is, do we want to incorporate the moon and space into our sphere of economic activity or not? That was the only question we had to answer. And his answer was yes, and here's how you do it. And his answer was, go back to the moon and start learning how to use this material. So I went through that. I know that's long and involved, and it's a little rambling too. But I mentioned this to say, when I started out walking around with my little pile of view graphs, and I just got a couple of people to listen to me, and then they told a couple of people, and then they told more people, that idea permeated up the chain somehow. I didn't talk to everybody, and I never talked to the NASA administrator about this. I never talked to anybody at the White House. And the way I knew that they knew me there was they called me and asked me to be on the Aldrich Commission. So that was a bolt out of the blue for me. I had no idea they had read my stuff.
So you got it adopted into policy. Just, it sounds like you had a good presentation that people liked, you knew where to at least start the process, although you weren't really aware that you were starting a process.
But wait a minute. I'm not taking credit for this, all right? I want to make this clear. It was an idea whose time had come, okay?
Okay.
And that's sort of my point. If you've got a good idea and it makes sense in the grand cosmic scheme of things, and it's timely, it's not too soon and it's not too late, then you've got a chance to influence policy. And what happened was, I think, that the idea that we needed something beyond LEO, something that was challenging, that would give us new capabilities, and yet it couldn't be so far as to be totally distant on the multi-decadal scales, and yet at the same time it needed to be far enough away that we wouldn't be over in a couple of years either. And the moon fit that bill in every respect. And that's why the moon was made the principal objective of the vision. And I've been through this with the Mars guys all the time. They insist on saying, well, Bush said this was a Mars trip. And if you actually look at his speech, you know, and the moon is mentioned 11 times in the speech, and Mars is mentioned twice. And the activities that we were to do on the moon are spelled out specifically and in detail. And it's the most astonishing presidential speech I've ever seen. It's much better than the Kennedy speech, right? Kennedy just said, we're going to go to the moon, and we're going to do it in a decade. Bush said, we're going to go to the moon, and here's what we're going to do when we get there. And here's what it's going to give us. He said all that in the speech. That's all in there. And apparently nobody could be bothered to read it or listen to it. But it was one of the best presidential speeches on space ever. It obviously had a positive impact because the vision was codified into law by two different Congresses on two different occasions, in the 06 and the 08 authorizations, and the Congress was under control of two different parties in each case. So it was a bipartisan effort. So when, you know, I get a little annoyed when I see articles by people saying, well, we need a bipartisan space policy. Well, we damn well had one it was unilaterally canceled by the current administration.
But it was cheered on by many in the space community as well.
Of course, because they didn't like the idea of someone who actually knew what they wanted to do. They much prefer this endless stasis and Brownian motion that we're in.
Well, and they didn't like the idea of the government building big rockets. They wanted the private sector to build them, and then they
They wanted government money to be given to the private sector to build them. That's a different thing.
So, I guess I'll have to rephrase my challenge to people when I say, how do you intend to implement your policy? So I guess it would be, how do you know your policy is timely?
You don't. I mean, obviously you think it is, or else you wouldn't be advocating it.
Right. But
you don't know if objectively it's timely or not. And so, but you press on anyway. You assume, you hope, you try to make the case that your policy does make sense, that this is what I want to do, and here's why it makes sense now. And then you tell everybody and anybody that you can. And if it sticks, bravo and bully for you. And if it doesn't, you just keep trying. I don't know. You know, it's not – if you're going to get discouraged easily, then you shouldn't even start because, you know, look, I've been in this business now 35 years, and I've seen these things come and go, and – the future did not unfold the way I wanted it to, but at the same time, I've had a great time. I've been involved in some wonderful missions. I've had a lot of fun exploring the moon and finding out new things about it, and I've been able to make a living at it. And I think that's great. I mean, to my mind, that's a successful life. I mean, I didn't get to walk on the moon, but at the same time, I feel like I've been there. I've explored it with unmanned spacecraft, and I've had a great time doing it. And I still think there's a future there. I may be wrong, and maybe when I'm dead and buried, everyone will realize that going to the moon was a dumb idea to begin with. I don't think that's going to happen, but it could.
Well, we're going to bury you on the moon. I mean, that would be the ultimate.
That doesn't appeal. I mean, I love the moon, and I'm glad they did that for Gene Shoemaker, who was a great guy and really was a pioneer in many ways. But, you know, I've just had a good time studying it and being involved with it for so many years. It, it's It's just a great thing to do. It's a great way to spend your life.
Here, I have a couple of email questions that are piling up, and we may go a few minutes over if you have a little bit of extra time. I know it's
that's fine
for you. So this is John in Seattle, and John said, occasionally I come across controversy that says that we really don't know that there's sufficient water or water ice on the moon for anything commercial, and the question is not yet answered. Is there a definitive answer on water on the moon?
There is a definitive answer. We don't have it. So the way I deal with this issue, and I run into the same criticism, is that you develop a strategy where you systematically retire the oceans in a logical order. So, for example, we don't know how much ice is there, so we send a small mission to find out. We don't know what its physical is. Hello, are you still here?
Yeah, I'm still here. Okay. We're cutting out for some reason, but
no, somebody's ringing into my phone. That's
okay.
What it is. Never mind. So you retire the unknowns in a logical and systematic order, and if it turns out that thing conditions are not as you expect, then you adjust your plans and your architecture accordingly. You know, if it turns out that there's not enough water on the moon to support the kind of activity that I'm proposing, then we'll have to do something else.
So we don't know for sure that there's enough water on the moon for these activities.
No, we don't know. I think the evidence is very compelling, but again, I want to verify it. I mean, if you're going to spend billions of dollars doing something, you want to make sure that you have the best possible knowledge. So that you acquire that knowledge as you start implementing your program to verify it. And if you're wrong, you modify your architecture.
Randy is in Seattle as well, and he says, I'm surprised you haven't mentioned the lunar space elevator, which seems to me to be the best way to get access to the moon. Any comments?
Well, if he means the space elevator that's built on the moon, we have to be on the moon to build anything there. So that's way in the future. It's you know, there's a lot of technologies that you can look at once you're on the moon. One of my favorites is the old O'Neillian mass driver, where you just set up an electromagnetic system where you hurl stuff off the moon at escape velocity. And that's a great way, that's a great substitute for propulsive export. But again, you can't do anything like that until you're there. So it's important to get there and to get a foothold on it first.
Absolutely. So the missions that are planned to, like, go to the moon for water, and there's a couple of them, do you follow them? Like Shackleton is one that comes to mind. Do you follow these projects at all? Do you pay attention to them?
Well, right now there's a mission that I'm aware of, besides the Google Lunar X Prize thing that I'm involved in. There is a NASA mission called Resource Prospector. I wrote about that on the blog a couple months ago. And that will land a small rover probably at the South Pole. It'll land in the sunlight and then rove into the dark area, making measurements as it goes along. And it's not going to answer all of our questions, but it's going to get some good first-order ground truth where we don't have any right now. So, yes, I am following that mission. That's something that definitely needs to be done. That's a greatly scaled-down version of the mission that we originally had designed to follow LRO. There was a mission called the RLEP-2, that's Robotic Lunar Exploration Program Mission 2, and that was a lander and a rover to the dark areas of the poles. It was nuclear-powered, so it could have operated indefinitely at the poles of the moon.
Which comes first, humans returning to the moon and setting up some kind of an outpost or cislunar transportation?
Well, the latter has to come first, I think. You have to get to the moon first.
Yeah, but you can get there without establishing a transportation system.
Oh, you mean a
system.
Reusable infrastructure.
I mean a cislunar transportation system.
Well, I think you get them both simultaneously. I mean, there's no reason not to. I think the way I'm looking at this is that lunar resource development enables the cislunar transportation system. And the cislunar transportation system uses the output of the lunar resource base. So they are effectively the same project. And by building the system that takes you to and from the moon on a routine basis, you have the cislunar transportation system. They are the same thing. Because it energetically and in terms of mission times and loiter times and durations and delta Vs, all those are identical for cislunar space and for the lunar surface. If you can go to the moon and back routinely, then you can do everything that you would want to do in cislunar space.
Another email is from Sherry, who says she's in Berkeley, which is just a stepping stone away from me. And she says, David, I'm over at Cal working. I have an internship type of program. I'm a graduate student listening to the show using email. My question is, going to the moon or cislunar space or a lunar outpost or however you want to define it is always an either-or with the Mars group and now with the ARM mission. Does it have to be an either-or? When you have Mike Griffin on the show, he says it's about the choices we make on how we spend our money, and there's no reason that we have to choose either-or or none of the above, that we could, if we understood the value of all this properly, allocate resources so that these programs are not mutually exclusive of one another. I'd like to hear Dr. Spoutis' opinion on this.
Well, he's right in an objective sense, that certainly this society is wealthy enough to afford to do anything they want to do. And when you look at a $4 trillion federal budget per year, that's $4,000 billion, and you think the space program is getting $17 billion, it's ludicrous to claim that we can't afford to spend more. Now, there's a problem. The problem is that there is not enough political mass that agrees that space is an important enough priority to allocate more than $17 billion a year to it. Mike is right. I heard that program, and Mike is absolutely right that it's a choice we make. Well, that choice has been made, and the choice has been made repeatedly over the past 40 years, and that choice is not the choice that he and I want. That choice is not to give NASA a blank check, but the choice is to give NASA $17 billion and to say, here, do what you can. And unfortunately, at the current level of technical development, that can't do a hell of a lot. That does make it either or. Yes, we do cislunar or lunar base, or we don't do Mars, or we don't do ARM. So that's where the conflict comes in. Now, having said that, it's if you look at the budget for the last 30 years, it's pretty flat, and in fact, it's gone down in real terms. It used to be 1% of the budget, now it's 0.5%. Actually, it's less than 0.5%. It's about 0.33%. It's been so flat that there's not much hope for a substantial increase. But consider the following. One of the big hits against the vision, the VSE of the 2004 vision, was that it was never funded correctly. It was never properly funded. That is not true. The predicate of the VSE was laid out very clearly in the document that was issued at the same time that the speech was given. It basically showed this thing called the sand chart. The sand chart said that NASA would get a one-time augmentation to their budget, and that was to be determined by Congress, but it was supposed to be about $1.5 billion, and that after that, the NASA budget would grow with inflation. And the question to the agency was, can you go back to the moon and build this capability with that level of funding? And Sean O'Keefe looked at them and said, yes, I can do that. And so the original plan of the vision was not to for NASA to go away and develop an architecture that was unaffordable and then say, well, give us the money and we'll do it. It was to say, okay, here is the boundary condition. This is what we've got. How do we proceed? How do we move forward when this is the bounding limit? And their answer was that if they retired the shuttle, that would form a wedge that would allow exploration systems to be built that would gradually extend this to cislunar and beyond. Now, that was the original plan of the vision. So it is not a fact that the vision was underfunded. It is a fact that it was over-engineered. It was designed with an architecture that turned out, for a variety of reasons, and I don't blame them for this, they were doing the best they could, that would turn out to be unaffordable. It turned out to want to need more money than was available. And in fact, if you read the Augustine report, that's what that says, effectively. It says that this ESAS architecture, Project Constellation, will get us to the moon, it will give us the capabilities it advertises, but NASA needs about $3 billion more per year to implement it. And the Obama administration was not willing to give that much more money to NASA. Now, remember, this is the same administration that spent $1 trillion in its first year in existence that, to my knowledge, has not yet been fully accounted for. I don't know where all that money went. I mean, I've seen a lot of different articles. I've been trying to figure out where the $1 trillion went. It kind of evaporated. But they were not willing to give $3 billion more a year to NASA and to raise it from the $18 billion to $21 billion. That would have fully funded every part of Constellation, and we would be right now getting ready to fly the first missions with the Constellation system. But that was not the choice. So the question is, the reason it's either or is because we're all fighting for a very narrow sliver of the pie, and the reason that Congress is not terribly inclined to give NASA more than this is that NASA has not shown that they could spend more wisely. So, I mean, only a fool would. If I give you $1,000 and you go out and blow it in a couple of days, you come back and ask me for more. What's my incentive to give you more?
Well, wait a minute. Who in their right mind thinks Congress spends money wisely?
Well, that's a separate issue. What I'm saying is, we're talking about our goals in space, and are they adequately funded? And I'm saying they're not funded at the level I would like to see, and they're not funded at the level Mike Griffin would like to see, but they are funded at a fairly high level. I mean, $17 billion is not chicken feed. And it depends on how you spend it and what you're trying to do as to whether that's enough or not. So the reason we get into fights about whether to do this, that, or the other is because everybody wants all of that chunk of money, and it's considered a zero sum game. You know, my loss is your gain, and vice versa. So that's why we fight over scraps. We're basically dogs fighting over table scraps.
Does it have anything to do with a better appreciation of the value and importance and wealth building of space? Or that's just way down on the list?
The space program is kind of weird because it's one of those things, and I've always been struck by this in all my interactions with Congress. There are two groups of politicians in regard to space. There's a group that gets it and likes it, and there's a group that will never get it and will never like it. And that cuts across party lines, amazingly enough. It's not... you know, one party pro and one party anti, but there's definitely a pro space and an anti space, and they divide into two camps, and it splits along the parties, and there are members of each party in both camps.
And of course, there is no plan to get out of this treadmill, is there?
Well, I mean, this is the system we have, right? I mean, it's right. Democracy is ugly, and it's horrible, and the only thing worse is all the others. So it's the system we have, and we have to work with it. Now, lest you think I'm consigning us to the seventh circle of hell here, I think that it is possible to craft a program that answers your correspondence. Basic question. I have argued, and I continue to argue, and I will argue this to my dying day, that going to the moon and developing a cislunar transportation infrastructure and developing lunar water as a fuel resource is the shortest way to get to Mars. Because unless you have that, you have to stage your Mars mission launching everything from the bottom of the deepest gravity well in the inner solar system. And that's just a dumb way to go to Mars. I mean, that's basically launching the mass of 1 to 2 ISSs, fully fueled space stations, and then sending it on a 3-year journey. And that's just the stupidest way to launch a mission that I can think of. I would much rather build a system that gradually and incrementally is able to assemble and marshal the supplies you need for a Mars mission at some point like Earth-Moon L1, and then depart from there. And you can do that if you're harvesting water on the moon. I argue if a Mars spacecraft is going to be 80% propellant, all right, that's just the rocket equation. And it makes sense to bring your dumb mass, the mass that's low information density, from the shallow well, gravity well of the moon, rather than dragging it up from the deep gravity well of the Earth. And so I argue that going to the moon and doing all these things is the way to enable human Mars missions. I frankly don't think we're ever going to get there if it's going to be staged in the Apollo mode. I don't think it's viable. You've got to put the equivalent of the International Space Station in LEO. The analysis I saw, and if you look at the last Mars design reference mission, not only do they call for a nuclear thermal departure stage, which doesn't exist, so that's a whole new technology development, they also call for anywhere from 8 to 10 Ares V class heavy lift launches. Now, think about that for a minute. That is effectively the entire output of the Apollo Saturn V program for one mission to Mars, of which everything will be thrown away except the return vehicle. So I don't think that doesn't make any sense to me. That's not a smart way to go to the planets. A smart way to go to the planets is develop a system that gradually gets you there by marshaling what you need from what you find in space. And that's the value of going to the moon.
Well, are you available to be the next NASA administrator?
Oh, they don't want me. Yeah, I'm the last guy they would want in that job.
All the people with good ideas say they don't want me.
Well, it's not that so much as that, you know, they want people who are able to get up and with a straight face make statements like the arm is good value for money, and I couldn't do that. You know, if someone asked me what's your opinion of this, I'd tell them, and I'd be out of work in 5 minutes.
Yeah, you couldn't be the White House press officer either, I take it, then.
No, I'm not interested in that job, for sure.
for any president.
Exactly.
In summary, Paul,
yep,
as 2014, which seems to have gone by really, really fast, we're about to go into 2015. Do we expect the same old, same old? Do you see anything that's going to change? What do we have to look forward to?
I'm afraid I have to say that it looks like the same old to me. I don't see any. There's no inclination on the part of the agency or this administration to change course, whatever that is. There's no. Congress does not run NASA, right? They can fund programs and they can scold and admonish and they can authorize, but they don't run the agency. So NASA's going to do what it's going to do. And what it's going to do for the next couple years looks pretty lame as far as I can tell. Now whether that changes in 2 years with a new administration, I don't think anybody knows. And that's regardless of who gets in there. Space is kind of funny in that it's one of those things that seems to require presidential leadership, but in actual fact, what you really need is a group of advisors in the various key spots, like the White House, OMB, and NASA, and on the Hill, who see the value in something, and then all they get together and make a deal, and it happens. That seems to be the way things like this, big projects, work in this country. And this is, I'm not telling anything that's new. Everyone knows this. But you think about it. This is why I think a lot of the argument about getting people excited, getting the public on your side, is really quite irrelevant. The public doesn't really care what we do in space. They're not against it. They're not for it. They're just kind of neutral. And NASA sees that as a problem. And I see it as an asset. I think neutrality is a good thing. Because what that means is that people will give you a lot of latitude to do something that may, to them, may look kind of dumb initially, but in the long run actually pays off. So it's an advantage that NASA has never recognized. I'm mystified by this. They seem wedded to this idea of public engagement, a model that I think has been shown not to work. They've been trying to get the public excited for years about going to Mars to look for fossil bugs, and it just ain't happening. I mean, you look at any poll, and yeah, the space cadets love it, but nobody else does. But at the same time, nobody's calling for the dismantlement of the agency either. So what that tells me is there's an opportunity to use that lukewarm, wishy-washy support as a base to springboard the creation of a true spacefaring infrastructure. And that's the way I would like to see the program evolve. That's what I've been advocating.
Do you need a charismatic NASA administrator?
No, you don't. You need someone who knows what the hell they're doing and what they're trying to do. Part of the problem with the administrator's job is really not to be a technical whiz kid. His job is to make sure that Congress feels like they're involved, that they're informed. He doesn't lie to them. He tells them that when I'm having difficulties, here's what's going to take to fix it. He gives them a straight answer. When they ask him if something went wrong, what happened, he says, you know, I screwed up and here's what I did. And yet at the same time, he's someone that they can trust. They feel they can go to and rely on, and he'll do the job that Congress asks him to do. And that's what you need an administrator. You know, that's why the best administrators, people like James Webb, were guys that were basically backslapping good old boys from Oklahoma and Texas, all right, who got along with those guys on the Hill and was able to grease the wheels and keep things going. Jim Webb probably didn't know what end of a rocket the exhaust came out of, and yet he was the best administrator NASA ever had because he knew how to deal with the Congress. That's the NASA administrator's job.
Interesting. So you would not expect any radical anything from the midterm or even the presidential elections coming up in 2016?
Well, certainly not from the midterm. The presidential election, of course, is always a wild card. I mean, who would have thought that the idea of lunar return would become an issue in the Republican primary in 2012? All right, and that now I'm referring, of course, to the famous Newt Gingrich comment that then Mitt Romney jumped on and derided in public at length on two occasions. And, you know, I was just appalled at that. apparently, Scott Pace had ties with the Romney campaign. I actually wrote Scott a letter. I said, can you please get him to shut up about the moon? And apparently it took, because I didn't hear him mention it again. But, I mean, I thought I was just appalled by that because, well, Newt may have been misguided in what he was suggesting.
Oh, yeah, the 51st state or something
like
that.
Yeah, well, whatever it was. Yeah. I mean, it was a Newt kind of comment. It was provocative and interesting and big sky, and that's the way he is. But I thought Romney's reaction to it was just appalling. And it told me that he had a singular lack of expansive vision. He couldn't see that the moon had any value.
No,
his immediate instinct was to denigrate the idea. That's worse than someone who's completely ignorant. I mean, that's a form of ignorance that's actually offensive to me.
And he apparently seems to be running again, maybe, I don't know. But,
no way.
But
I will go out on a limb here. I don't ordinarily make predictions, but I predict he will not run in 2016. And if he does, no Republican will even dream of giving him a second chance. He's not Richard Nixon.
No, and many of us believe he laid down on the job, so, you know.
Yeah.
Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But if you quit, you don't get a lot of respect. But that's a whole other show and another story. Okay, anything I should have asked you that you wanted to say or that we've forgotten to talk about or that you wanted to bring to our attention?
No, we've droned on quite enough, I think. I think your listeners need a break. I know I do. But as usual, I always enjoy being on the show with you and chatting with you. It's always a lot of fun.
Yes, it is, and somehow we will prevail. I do hope we... It seems so ridiculous that we can't figure out the rationale to develop cislunar space and to do some of these things. I mean, certainly when we need to create wealth in this country and expand our economy, what better ways to do it? It's beyond my, you know, if interest rates go up 3-4%, how are we going to even service our debt in this country?
You're absolutely right. I mean, there are problems of extraordinary magnitude facing us, and they always have, and we've always found a way to deal with them. It's easy to get depressed, and God knows it happens to me. I get depressed too sometimes, but at the same time, there's always a glimmer of hope because not everyone is brain dead. There are people who are following what's going on and who do realize that there is value to some of the things we've been talking about. And it's just a matter of time before they ultimately people realize that. So I'm not at all ready to go out and commit suicide or harikari. I firmly believe that eventually the right ideas will prevail.
You have an email that came in from St. John, New Brunswick. You ready to take this one? And it'll be the last one of the show.
Yeah, sure.
So this is from Phil Blackman, who's in the physics department at the University of New Brunswick.
Yes, I've corresponded with him.
As do I. Paul, in the report from the 2004 commission, there was talk of virtual space universities to enhance space education. Just wondering if you remember anything about this and whether anything ever came of this idea.
Yeah, actually, that was implemented in a way. I mean, we don't have virtual universities, but NASA has tried on several occasions to have these virtual workshops and virtual conferences that use the internet and Adobe Connect and WebEx and things like that to kind of give the ability to have group meetings and interactions and seminars and discussions remotely, and it's had mixed success. I've participated in a couple of them. I have to say that a lot of my colleagues hate them. They'll participate and they'll say, "Well, this is an awful way to interact. I can't stand it." My experience with them has been very positive. I've actually enjoyed them. To my mind, they have a huge advantage, and that is it saves me from traveling. As the one thing I really hate is to fly on a commercial jet. It's one of the most gruesome endurance tests I can imagine.
I'll second that. Yeah,
and having these virtual meetings is a way for me to avoid that. So I am all in favor of them, and I think the virtual university idea is merely an extension of that. I think we're well on the way to something like that. The technology improves all the time. These things get better and better, and I think eventually we'll be able to do that. We're almost there right now.
Phil, the last time I taught my UND graduate class, I did it via Adobe Connect, and we merged together the distance learning class and the on-campus Grand Forks class. And everyone either came into the classroom if they were in Grand Forks and were in the audiovisual classroom, and then the distance students were in their house with Adobe Connect. They had their dog sitting on their lap, you know, the whole thing. And it was the best class I have taught. I mean, I did not know that I would like it, and I would go out of my way to do that model again. And I got to know lots of students that I wouldn't necessarily know visually, and it was great. And the students liked having the distance part merged with the on-campus part rather than looking at DVDs and doing all this other crap that you do. And it was a great model. And like you, Paul, I didn't have to go to Grand Forks, which is a real travel ordeal given the air connections, and I loved it. I would not hesitate to do that model again.
Yeah, I think that's a technology that whose time is almost here.
And by the way, it worked flawless with Adobe Connect. We never had any problems with it. It just the resolution, all of that. It was great. And we were all together, you know, virtually. You know, you could see everybody in the classroom, no matter whether they were at home in their living room or their kitchen or, you know, wherever they were. And I think it's really a way of the future. It just was flawless.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. With that, my friend, I will let you go and thank you for being with us and look forward to talking to you again down the road.
Thank you, David. I enjoyed it.
Okay. That's it, everybody. Check the newsletters for Space Show programs coming up for the balance of the week. And thank you all for participating. Goodbye from Paul and myself and the Space Show.